him to marry, leavings or no. Circe's quiver was empty. Make your offer, then. But God save you all, if Joff does not like this girl. I'm so pleased we can agree, Tyrion said. Now which of us shall go to Bitterbridge? We must reach Solaris with our offer before his blood can cool. You mean to send one of the council? I can scarcely expect the Knight of Flowers to treat with Bronn or Shagga, can I? The Tyrells are proud. His sister wasted no time trying to twist the situation to her advantage. Sir Jaslyn Bywater is nobly born. Send him. Tyrion shook his head. We need someone who can do more than repeat our words and fetch back a reply. Our envoy must speak for king and council and settle the matter quickly. The hand speaks for the king's voice. Candlelight gleamed green as wildfire in Cersei's eyes. If we send you, Tyrion, it will be as if Joffrey went himself. And who better? You wield words as skillfully as Jaime wields a sword. Are you that eager to get me out of the city, Cersei? You are too kind, sister, but it seems to me that a boy's mother is better fitted to arrange his marriage than any uncle, and you have a gift for winning friends that I could never hope to match. Her eyes narrowed. Joff needs me at his side. Your Grace, my Lord Hand, said Littlefinger, the king needs both of you here. Let me go in your stead. You? What gain does he see in this? Tyrion wondered. I am of the king's council, yet not the king's blood, so I would make a poor hostage. I knew Solaris passing well when he was here at court, and gave him no cause to mislike me. Mace Tyrell bears me no enmity that I know of, and I flatter myself that I am not unskilled in negotiations. He has us. Tyrion did not trust Pataia Baelish, nor did he want the man out of his sight. Yet what other choice was left him? It must be Littlefinger or Tyrion himself, and he knew full well that if he left King's Landing for any length of time, all that he had managed to accomplish would be undone. There is fighting between here and Bitterbridge, he said cautiously, and you can be past certain that Lord Stannis will be dispatching his own shepherds to gather in his brother's wayward lambs. I've never been frightened of shepherds. It's the sheep who trouble me. Still, I suppose an escort might be in order. I can spare 100 gold cloaks. 500. 300. And 40 more, 20 knights, with as many squires. If I arrive without a knightly tale, the Tyrells will think me of small account. That was true enough. Agreed. I'll include Horror and Slubber in my party, and send them on to their Lord Father afterward. A gesture of goodwill. We need Paxter Redwine, he's Mace Tyrell's oldest friend, and a great power in his own right. And a traitor, the Queen said, balking. The Arbor would have declared for Renly with all the rest, except that Redwine knew full well his whelps would suffer for it. Renly is dead, Your Grace, Littlefinger pointed out, and neither Stannis nor Lord Paxter will have forgotten how Redwine galleys closed the sea during the siege of Storm's End. Restore the twins, and perchance we may win Redwine's love. Cersei remained unconvinced. The others can keep his love. I want his swords and sails. Holding tight to those twins is the best way to make certain that we'll have them. Tyrion had the answer. Then let us send Sir Hobber back to the Arbor and keep Sir Arys here. Lord Paxter ought to be clever enough to riddle out the meaning of that, I should think. The suggestion was carried without protest, but Littlefinger was not done. We'll want horses, swift and strong. The fighting will make remounts hard to come by. A goodly supply of gold will also be needed for those gifts we spoke of earlier. Take as much as you require. If the city falls, Stannis will steal it all anyway. I want my commission in writing, a document that will leave Mace Tyrell in no doubt as to my authority, granting me full power to treat with him concerning this match and any other arrangements that might be required, and to make binding pledges in the king's name. It should be signed by Joffrey and every member of this council, and bear all our seals. Tyrion shifted uncomfortably. Done. Will that be all? I remind you there's a long road between here and Bitterbridge. I'll be riding it before dawn breaks, Littlefinger rose. I trust that on my return the king will see that I am suitably rewarded for my valiant efforts in his cause. Varys giggled. Joffrey is such a grateful sovereign. I am certain you will have no cause to complain, my good, brave lord. The queen was more direct. What do you want, Pataya? Littlefinger glanced at Tyrion with a sly smile. I shall have to give that some consideration. No doubt I'll think of something. He sketched an airy bow and took his leave, as casual as if he were off to one of his brothels. Tyrion glanced out of the window. The fog was so thick that he could not even see the curtain wall across the yard. A few dim lights shone indistinct through that greyness. A foul day for travel, he thought. He did not envy Pataya Baelish. We had best see to drawing up those documents. Lord Varys, send for parchment and quill, and someone will need to wake Joffrey. It was still grey and dark when the meeting finally ended. Varys scurried off alone, his soft slippers whisking along the floor. The Lannisters lingered a moment by the door. "How comes your chain, brother?" the Queen asked, as Sir Preston fastened a vair-lined cloth of silver cloak about her shoulders. "Link by link it grows longer. We should thank the gods that Sir Courtney Penrose is as stubborn as he is. Stannis will never march north with Storm's End untaken in his rear."
"Tyrion, I know that we've not always agreed on policy, but it seems to me that I was wrong about you. You are not so big a fool as I imagined. In truth, I realize now that you have been a great help. For that I thank you. You must forgive me if I have spoken to you harshly in the past."
"Must I?" He gave her a shrug and a smile. "Sweet sister, you have said nothing that requires forgiveness."
"Today, you mean?" They both laughed, and Cersei leaned over and planted a quick, soft kiss on his brow. Too astonished for words, Tyrion could only watch her stride off down the hall, Sir Preston at her side.
"Have I lost my wits? Or did my sister just kiss me?" he asked Brunn when she was gone.
"Was it so sweet?"
"It was anticipated."
Cersei had behaved queerly of late. Tyrion found it very unsettling.
"I am trying to recall the last time she kissed me. I could not have been more than 6 or 7. Jamie had dared her to do it."
"The woman's finally taken note of your charms."
"No," Tyrion said.
"No, the woman is hatching something. Best find out what, Bronn. You know, I hate surprises."
Bran. A light snow was falling. Bran could feel the flakes on his face melting as they touched his skin like the gentlest of rains. He sat straight atop his horse, watching as the iron portcullis was winched upward. Try as he might to keep calm, his heart was fluttering in his chest.
"Are you ready?" Rob asked.
Bran nodded, trying not to let his fear show. He had not been outside Winterfell since his fall, but he was determined to ride out as proud as any knight.
"Let's ride, then!"
Rob put his heels into his big grey-and-white gelding, and the horse walked under the portcullis.
"Go!"
Bran whispered to his own horse. He touched her neck lightly, and the small chestnut filly started forward. Bran had named her Dancer. She was 2 years old, and Joseph had said she was smarter than any horse had a right to be. They had trained her special to respond to rein and voice and touch. Up to now, Bran had only ridden her around the yard. At first, Joseph or Hodor would lead her, while Bran sat strapped to her back in the oversized saddle the imp had drawn up for him. But for the past fortnight he had been riding her on his own, trotting her round and round and growing bolder with every circuit. They passed beneath the gatehouse, over the drawbridge, through the outer walls. Summer and Grey Wind came loping beside them, sniffing at the wind. Close behind came Theon Greyjoy, with his long bow and a quiver of broadheads. He had a mind to take a deer, he had told them. He was followed by 4 guardsmen in mail shirts and coifs, and Joseph, a stick-thin stableman, whom Rob had named Master of Horse while Holland was away. Maester Lewin brought up the rear, riding on a donkey. Bran would have liked it better if he and Rob had gone off alone, just the two of them, but Hal Mullen would not hear of it, and Maester Lewin backed him. If Bran fell off his horse or injured himself, the maester was determined to be with him. Beyond the castle lay the market square, its wooden stalls deserted now. They rode down the muddy streets of the village, past rows of small, neat houses of log and undressed stone. Less than 1 in 5 were occupied, thin tendrils of wood smoke curling up from their chimneys. The rest would fill up one by one as it grew colder. When the snow fell and the ice winds howled down out of the north, old Nan said, farmers left their frozen fields and distant holdfasts, loaded up their wagons, and then the winter town came alive. Bran had never seen it happen, but Maester Lewin said the day was looming closer. The end of the long summer was near at hand. Winter is coming. A few villagers eyed the direwolves anxiously as the riders went past, and one man dropped the wood he was carrying as he shrank away in fear, but most of the town folk had grown used to the sight. They bent the knee when they saw the boys, and Rob greeted each of them with a lordly nod. With his legs unable to grip, the swaying motion of the horse made Bran feel unsteady at first, but the huge saddle, with its thick horn and high back, cradled him comfortably, and the straps around his chest and thighs would not allow him to fall. After a time, the rhythm began to feel almost natural. His anxiety faded, and a tremulous smile crept across his face. 2 serving wenches stood beneath the sign of the Smoking Log, the local alehouse. When Theon Greyjoy called out to them, the younger girl turned red and covered her face. Theon spurred his mount to move up beside Rob. "Sweet Kyra," he said with a laugh. "She squirms like a weasel in bed. But say a word to her on the street and she blushes pink as a maid. Did I ever tell you about the night that she and Bessa—" "Not where my brother can hear, Theon," Rob warned him with a glance at Bran. Bran looked away and pretended not to have heard, but he could feel Greyjoy's eyes on him. No doubt he was smiling. He smiled a lot, as if the world were a secret joke that only he was clever enough to understand. Rob seemed to admire Theon and enjoyed his company, but Bran had never warmed to his father's ward. Rob rode closer. "You're doing well, Bran." "I want to go faster," Bran said. Rob smiled. "As you will." He sent his gelding into a trot. The wolves raced after him. Bran snapped the reins sharply, and Dancer picked up her pace. He heard a shout from Theon Greyjoy and the hoofbeats of the other horses behind him. Bran's cloak billowed out, rippling in the wind, and the snow seemed to rush at his face. Rob was well ahead, glancing back over his shoulder from time to time to make sure Bran and the others were following. He snapped the reins again. Smooth as silk, Dancer slid into a gallop. The distance closed. By the time he caught Rob, on the edge of the Wolf's Wood, 2 miles beyond the winter town, they had left the others well behind.
"I can ride!" Bran shouted, grinning. It felt almost as good as flying.
"I'd race you, but I fear you'd win." Rob's tone was light and joking, yet Bran could tell that something was troubling his brother underneath the smile. "I don't want to race." Bran looked around for the direwolves. Both had vanished into the wood. "Did you hear Summer howling last night?" "Grey Wind was restless too," Rob said. His auburn hair had grown shaggy and unkempt, and a reddish stubble covered his jaw, making him look older than his 15 years. "Sometimes I think they know things, sense things," Rob sighed. "I never know how much to tell you, Bran. I wish you were older." "I'm 8 now," Bran said. 8 isn't so much younger than 15, and I'm the heir to Winterfell after you."
"So you are," Rob sounded sad, and even a little scared.
"Bran, I need to tell you something. There was a bird last night from King's Landing. Maester Lewin woke me." Bran felt a sudden dread. "Dark wings, dark words," old Nan always said. And of late, the messenger ravens had been proving the truth of that proverb. When Rob wrote to the Lord Commander of the Night's Watch, the bird that came back brought word that Uncle Benjen was still missing. Then a message had arrived from the Eyrie for Mother, but that had not been good news either. She did not say when she meant to return, only that she had taken the imp as prisoner. Bran had sort of liked the little man, yet the name Lannister sent cold fingers creeping up his spine. There was something about the Lannisters, something he ought to remember, but when he tried to think what, he felt dizzy, and his stomach clenched hard as a stone. Rob spent most of that day locked behind closed doors with Maester Lewin, Theon Greyjoy, and Halas Mollen. Afterwards, riders were sent out on fast horses, carrying Rob's commands throughout the north. Bran heard talk of Moat Cailin, the ancient stronghold the first men had built at the top of the neck. No one ever told him what was happening, yet he knew it was not good. And now another raven, another message. Bran clung to hope. Was the bird from Mother? Is she coming home? The message was from Alan in King's Landing. Jorah Cassel is dead, and Will, and Heward as well, murdered by the Kingslayer. Rob lifted his face to the snow, and the flakes melted on his cheeks. May the gods give them rest. Bran did not know what to say. He felt as if he'd been punched. Jorah had been captain of the household guard at Winterfell since before Bran was born. They killed Jorah? He remembered all the times Jorah had chased him over the roofs. He could picture him striding across the yard in mail and plate, or sitting at his accustomed place on the bench in the great hall, joking as he ate. Why would anyone kill Jorah? Rob shook his head numbly, the pain plain in his eyes. I don't know, and, Bran, that's not the worst of it. Father was caught beneath a falling horse in the fight. Alan says his leg was shattered, and Maester Pycelle has given him the milk of the poppy, but they aren't sure when he... The sound of hoofbeats made him glance down the road to where Theon and the others were coming up. When he will wake, Rob finished. He laid his hand on the pommel of his sword then, and he went on in the solemn voice of Rob the Lord. Bran, I promise you, whatever may happen, I will not let this be forgotten. Something in his tone made Bran feel even more fearful. What will you do? He asked as Theon Greyjoy reined in beside them. Theon thinks I should call the banners, Rob said. Blood for blood. For once Greyjoy did not smile. His lean, dark face had a hungry look to it, and black hair fell down across his eyes. Only the Lord can call the banners, Bran said, as the snow drifted down on them. If your father dies, Theon said, Rob will be Lord of Winterfell. He won't die, Bran screamed at him. Rob took his hand. He won't die, not father, he said calmly. Still,
The honour of the North is in my hands now. When our Lord Father took his leave of us, he told me to be strong for you and for Rickon. I'm almost a man grown, Bran.
Bran shivered. I wish Mother was back, he said miserably. He looked around for Maester Lewin. His donkey was visible in the far distance, trotting over a rise. Does Maester Lewin say to call the banners too?
The Maester is as timid as an old woman, said Theon.
Father always listened to his counsel, Bran reminded his brother. Mother, too.
I listened to him, Rob said. I listened to everyone.
The joy Bran had felt at the ride was gone, melted away like the snowflakes on his face. Not so long ago, the thought of Rob calling the banners and riding off to war would have filled him with excitement, but now he felt only dread.
Can we go back now? He said. I'm cold.
Rob glanced around. We need to find the wolves. Can you stand to go a bit longer?
I can go as long as you can.
Maester Lewin had warned him to keep the ride short for fear of saddle sores, but Bran would not admit to weakness in front of his brother. He was sick of the way everyone was always fussing over him and asking how he was.
Let's hunt down the hunters then, Rob said.
Side by side, they urged their mounts off the King's Road and struck out into the Wolf's Wood. Theon dropped back and followed well behind, talking and joking with the guardsmen. It was nice under the trees. Bran kept Dancer to a walk, holding the reins lightly and looking all around him as they went. He knew this wood, but he had been so long confined to Winterfell that he felt as though he were seeing it for the first time. The smells filled his nostrils, the sharp, fresh tang of pine needles, the earthy odour of wet, rotting leaves, the hint of animal musk and distant cooking fires. He caught a glimpse of a black squirrel moving through the snow-covered branches of an oak, and paused to study the silvery web of an empress spider. Theon and the others fell farther and farther behind until Bran could no longer hear their voices. From ahead came the faint sound of rushing water. It grew louder until they reached the stream. Tears stung his eyes.
Bran? Rob asked. What's wrong?
Bran shook his head.
I was just remembering, he said. Jorry brought us here once to fish for trout. You and me and John, do you remember?
I remember, Rob said, his voice quiet and sad.
I didn't catch anything, Bran said, but John gave me his fish on the way back to Winterfell. Will we ever see John again?
We saw Uncle Benjen when the king came to visit, Rob pointed out. John will visit too, you'll see.
The stream was running high and fast. Rob dismounted and led his gelding across the ford. In the deepest part of the crossing, the water came up to mid-thigh. He tied his horse to a tree on the far side and waded back across for Bran and Dancer. The current foamed around rock and root, and Bran could feel the spray on his face as Rob led him over. It made him smile. For a moment he felt strong again and whole. He looked up at the trees and dreamed of climbing them, right up to the very top, with the whole forest spread out beneath him.
They were on the far side when they heard the howl. A long, rising wail that moved through the trees like a cold wind. Bran raised his head to listen.
Summer, he said.
No sooner had he spoken than a second voice joined the first. They've made a kill, Rob said as he remounted. I'd best go and bring them back. Wait here. Theon and the others should be along shortly.
I want to go with you, Bran said.
I'll find them faster by myself. Rob spurred his gelding and vanished into the trees. Once he was gone, the woods seemed to close in around Bran. The snow was falling more heavily now. Where it touched the ground, it melted, but all about him, rock and root and branch wore a thin blanket of white. As he waited, he was conscious of how uncomfortable he felt. He could not feel his legs. hanging useless in the stirrups, but the strap around his chest was tight and chafing, and the melting snow had soaked through his gloves to chill his hands. He wondered what was keeping Theon and Maester Luin and Joseph and the rest. When he heard the rustle of leaves, Bran used his rein to make dance a turn, expecting to see his friends, but the ragged men who stepped out onto the bank of the stream were strangers. "Good day to you," he said nervously. One look, and Bran knew they were neither foresters nor farmers. He was suddenly conscious of how richly he was dressed. His surcoat was new, dark grey wool with silver buttons, and a heavy silver pin fastened his fur-trimmed cloak at the shoulders. His boots and gloves were lined with fur as well.
"All alone, are you?"
said the biggest of them, a bald man with a raw, wind-burnt face.
"Lost in the wolf's wood, poor lad."
"I'm not lost." Bran did not like the way the strangers were looking at him. He counted four, but when he turned his head, he saw two others behind him. "My brother rode off just a moment ago, and my guard will be here shortly."
"Your guard, is it?"
a second man said. Grey stubble covered his gaunt face.
"And what will they be guarding, my little lord? Is that a silver pin I see on your cloak?"
"Pretty," said a woman's voice. She scarcely looked like a woman, tall and lean, with the same hard face as the others, her hair hidden beneath a bowl-shaped half-helm. The spear she held was 8 feet of black oak, tipped in rusted steel.
"Let's have a look," said the big bald man.
Bran watched him anxiously. The man's clothes were filthy, fallen almost to pieces. Patched here was brown, and here was blue, and there was a dark green, and faded everywhere to grey. But once the cloak might have been black. The grey stubbly man wore black rags too, he saw with a sudden start. Suddenly Bran remembered the oathbreaker his father had beheaded. The day they had found the wolf pups, that man had worn black as well, and father said he had been a deserter from the night's watch. "No man is more dangerous," he remembered Lord Eddard saying. "The deserter knows his life is forfeit if he is taken, so he will not flinch from any crime, no matter how vile or cruel."
"The pin, lad," the big man said. He held out his hand. "We'll take the horse too," said another of them, a woman shorter than Rob, with a broad, flat face and lank yellow hair. "Get down and be quick about it."
A knife slid from her sleeve into her hand, its edge jagged as a saw.
"No," Bran blurted, "I can't."
The big man grabbed his reins before Bran could think to wheel Dance around and gallop off.
"You can, lordling, and will, if you know what's good for you." "Steve, look how he's strapped on," the tall woman pointed with her spear. "Might be it's the truth he's telling."
"Straps, is it?" Steve said. He drew a dagger from a sheath at his belt.
"There's ways to deal with straps." "You some kind of cripple?" asked the short woman.
Bran flared. "I'm Brandon Stark of Winterfell, and you'd better let go of my horse, or I'll see you all dead." The gaunt man, with a grey stubbled face, laughed.
"The boy is a Stark, true enough. Only a Stark would be fool enough to threaten where smarter men would beg." "Cut his little cock off and stuff it in his mouth," suggested the short woman. "That should shut him up." "You're as stupid as you are ugly, Harley," said the tall woman. "The boy's worth nothing dead but alive. Gods be damned, think what Mance would give to have Benjen Stark's own blood to hostage."
"Mance be damned," the big man cursed. "You want to go back there, Usher? More fool you. Think the White Walkers would care if you have a hostage?" He turned back to Bran and slashed at the strap around his thigh. The leather parted with a sigh. The stroke had been quick and careless, biting deep. Looking down, Bran glimpsed pale flesh where the wool of his legging had parted. Then the blood began to flow. He watched the red stain spread, feeling light-headed, curiously apart. There'd been no pain, not even a hint of feeling. The big man grunted in surprise.
"Put down your steel now, and I promise you, you shall have a quick and painless death,"
Rob called out. Bran looked up in desperate hope, and there he was. The strength of his words were undercut by the way his voice cracked with strain. He was mounted, the bloody carcass of an elk slung across the back of his horse, his sword in a gloved hand. "The brother," said the man with a grey, stubbly face.
"He's a fierce one," mocked the short woman. "Harley," they called her. "You mean to fight us, boy?" "Don't be a fool, lad. You're one against six."
The tall woman, Usher, levelled her spear.
"Off the horse, and throw down the sword. We'll thank you kindly for the mount and for the venison, and you and your brother can be on your way."
Rob whistled. They heard the faint sound of soft feet on wet leaves. The undergrowth parted, low-hanging branches giving up their accumulation of snow, and grey wind and summer emerged from the green. Summer sniffed the air and growled.
"Wolves," gasped Harley.
"Dire wolves," Bran said. Still half-grown, they were as large as any wolf he had ever seen. But the differences were easy to spot if you knew what to look for. Maester Lewin and Farlan, the kennel master, had taught him. A direwolf had a bigger head and longer legs in proportion to its body, and its snout and jaw were markedly leaner and more pronounced. There was something gaunt and terrible about them as they stood there amid the gently falling snow. Fresh blood spotted Grey Wind's muzzle.
"Dogs," the big bald man said contemptuously. "Yet I'm told there's nothing like a wolfskin cloak to warm a man by night."
He made a sharp gesture.
"Take them."
Rob shouted,
"Winterfell,"
and kicked his horse. The gelding plunged down the bank as the ragged men closed. A man with an axe rushed in, shouting and heedless. Rob's sword caught him full in the face with a sickening crunch and a spray of bright blood. The man with the gaunt, stubbly face made a grab for the reins, and for half a second he had them, and then Grey Wind was on him, bearing him down. He fell back into the stream with a splash and a shout, flailing wildly with his knife as his head went under. The direwolf plunged in after him, and the white water turned red where they had vanished. Rob and Usher matched blows in midstream. Her long spear was a steel-headed serpent, flashing out at his chest, once, twice, three times. But Rob parried every thrust with his longsword, turning the point aside. On the fourth or fifth thrust, the tall woman overextended herself and lost her balance, just for a second. Rob charged, riding her down. A few feet away, Summer darted in and snapped at Harley. The knife bit at his flank. Summer slid away, snarling, and came rushing in again. This time his jaws closed around her calf. Holding the knife with both hands, the small woman stabbed down, but the direwolf seemed to sense the blade coming. He pulled free for an instant, his mouth full of leather and cloth and bloody flesh. When Harley stumbled and fell, he came at her again, slamming her backward, teeth tearing at her belly. The sixth man ran from the carnage, but not far. As he went scrambling up the far side of the bank, Grey Wind emerged from the stream, dripping wet. He shook the water off and bounded after the running man, hamstringing him with a single snap of his teeth, and going for the throat as the screaming man slid back down toward the water. And then there was no one left but the big man, Stiv. He slashed at Bran's chest strap, grabbed his arm, and yanked. Suddenly Bran was falling. He sprawled on the ground, his legs tangled under him, one foot in the stream. He could not feel the cold of the water, but he felt the steel when Stiv pressed his dagger to his throat.
"Back away," the man warned, "or I'll open the boy's windpipe, I swear it."
Rob reined his horse in, breathing hard. The fury went out of his eyes. and his sword arm dropped. In that moment, Bran saw everything. Summer was savaging Harley, pulling glistening blue snakes from her belly. Her eyes were wide and staring. Bran could not tell whether she was alive or dead. The grey, stubbly man and the one with the axe lay unmoving. But Usha was on her knees, crawling towards her fallen spear. Grey wind padded toward her, dripping wet. "Call him off," the big man shouted. "Call them both off, or the crippled boy dies now." "Grey wind, Summer, to me," Rob said. The direwolves stopped, turned their heads. Grey wind loped back to Rob. Summer stayed where he was, his eyes on Bran and the man beside him. He growled. His muzzle was wet and red, but his eyes burned. Usha used the butt end of her spear to lever herself back to her feet. Blood leaked from a wound on the upper arm where Rob had cut her. Bran could see sweat trickling down the big man's face. Stiv was as scared as he was, he realized. "Starks," the man muttered. "Bloody Starks." He raised his voice. "Usha, kill the wolves and get his sword." "Kill them yourself," she replied. "I'll not be getting near those monsters." For a moment, Stiv was at a loss. His hand trembled. Bran felt a trickle of blood where the knife pressed against his neck. The stench of the man filled his nose. He smelled of fear. "You," he called out to Rob, "you have a name?" "I'm Rob Stark, the heir to Winterfell." "This is your brother?" "Yes." "You want him alive? Do what I say. Off the horse." Rob hesitated a moment. Then slowly and deliberately, he dismounted and stood with his sword in hand. "Now, kill the wolves." Rob did not move. "You do it. The wolves or the boy?" "No," Bran screamed. If Rob did as they asked, Stiv would kill them both anyway, once the direwolves were dead. The bald man took hold of his hair with his free hand and twisted it cruelly till Bran sobbed in pain. "You shut your mouth, cripple, hear me?" He twisted harder. "You hear me?" A low thrum came from the woods behind them. Stiv gave a choked gasp as a half foot of razor-tipped broadhead suddenly exploded out of his chest. The arrow was bright red, as if it had been painted in blood. The dagger fell away from Bran's throat. The big man swayed and collapsed, face down in the stream. The arrow broke beneath him. Bran watched his life go swirling off in the water. Usha glanced around as Father's guardsman appeared from beneath the trees, steel in hand. She threw down her spear. "Mercy, my lord," she called to Rob. The guardsmen had a strange, pale look to their faces as they took in the scene of slaughter. They eyed the wolves uncertainly. And when Summer returned to Harley's corpse to feed, Joseph dropped the knife and scrambled for the bush, heaving. Even Maester Lewin seemed shocked as he stepped from behind a tree, but only for an instant. Then he shook his head and waded across the stream to Bran's side. "Are you hurt?" "He cut my leg," Bran said, "but I couldn't feel it." As the maester knelt to examine the wound, Bran turned his head. Theon Greyjoy stood beside a sentinel tree. His bow in hand, he was smiling, ever smiling. A half dozen arrows were thrust into the soft ground at his feet, but it had taken only one. "A dead enemy is a thing of beauty," he announced. "John always said you were an ass, Greyjoy," Rob said loudly. "I ought to chain you up in the yard and let Bran take a few practice shots at you. You should be thanking me for saving your brother's life." "What if you had missed the shot?" Rob said. "What if you'd only wounded him? What if you'd made his hand jump or hit Bran instead? For all you knew, the man might have been wearing a breastplate. All you could see was the back of his cloak. What would have happened to my brother then?" "Did you ever think of that, Greyjoy?" Theon's smile was gone. He gave a sullen shrug and began to pull his arrows from the ground one by one.
Rob glared at his guardsman. "Where were you?" he demanded of them. "I was sure you were close behind us."
The men traded unhappy glances.
"We were following, my lord," said Quint, the youngest of them, his beard a soft brown fuzz. "Only first, we waited for Maester Lewin and his ass. Oh, begging your pardons. And then, well, as it were..." He glanced over at Theon and quickly looked away abashed.
"I spied a turkey," Theon said, annoyed by the question. "How was I to know that you'd leave the boy alone?"
Rob turned his head to look at Theon once more. Bran had never seen him so angry, yet he said nothing. Finally, he knelt beside Maester Lewin. "How badly is my brother wounded?"
"No more than a scratch," the maester said. He wet a cloth in a stream to clean the cut. "Two of them wear the black," he told Rob as he worked.
Rob glanced over at where Stiv lay sprawled in the stream, his ragged black cloak moving fitfully as the rushing waters tugged at it.
"Deserters from the Night's Watch," he said grimly. "They must have been fools to come so close to Winterfell."
"Folly and desperation are oft times hard to tell apart," said Maester Lewin.
"Shall we bury them, my lord?" said Quint.
"They would not have buried us," Rob said.
"Hack off their heads. We'll send them back to the wall. Leave the rest for the carrion crows."
"And this one?" Quint jerked a thumb towards Usher.
Rob walked over to her. She was a head taller than he was, but she dropped her knees at his approach.
"Give me my life, my Lord of Stark, and I'm yours."
"Mine? What would I do with an oathbreaker?"
"I broke no oaths. Stiv and Wallen flew down off the wall, not me. The Black Crow's got no place for women."
Theon Greyjoy sauntered closer.
"Give her to the wolves," he urged Rob.
The woman's eyes went to what was left of Harley and just as quickly away. She shuddered. Even the guardsmen looked queasy.
"She's a woman," Rob said.
"A wildling," Bran told him. "She said they should keep me alive so they could take me to Mance Rayder."
"Do you have a name?" Rob asked her.
"Usher, as it please the lord," she muttered sourly.
Maester Lewin stood.
"We might do well to question her."
Bran could see the relief on his brother's face.
"As you say, maester. Wayne, bind her hands. She'll come back to Winterfell with us, and live or die by the truths she gives us."
Brain. They came upon the first corpse a mile from the crossroads. He swung beneath the limb of a dead tree whose blackened trunk still bore the scars of the lightning that had killed it. The carrion crows had been at work on his face, and wolves had feasted on his lower legs where they dangled near the ground. Only bones and rags remained below his knees, along with one well-chewed shoe, half covered by mud and mould. "What does he have in his mouth?" asked Podrick. Brienne had to steel herself to look. His face was grey and green and ghastly, his mouth open and distended. Someone had shoved a jagged white rock between his teeth. "A rock, or salt," said Septon Meribald. 50 yards farther on, they spied the second body. The scavengers had torn him down, so what remained of him was strewn on the ground beneath a frayed rope looped about the limb of an elm. Brain might have ridden past him unawares if Dog had not sniffed him out and loped into the weeds for a closer smell. "What do you have there, Dog?" Sir Hyle dismounted, strode after the dog, and came up with a half-helm. The dead man's skull was still inside it, along with some worms and beetles. "Good steel," he pronounced, "and not too badly dinted, though the lion's lost his head. Pod, would you like a helm?"
"Not that one. It's got worms in it."
"Worms wash out, lad. You're squeamish as a girl." Brain scowled at him. "It's too big for him. He'll grow into it."
"I don't want to," said Podrick.
Sir Hyle shrugged and tossed the broken helm back into the weeds, lion crest and all. Dog barked and went to lift his leg against the tree. After that, hardly 100 yards went by without a corpse, They dangled under ash and alder, beech and birch, larch and elm, hoary old willows and stately chestnut trees. Each man wore a noose around his neck and swung from a length of hempen rope, and each man's mouth was packed with salt. Some wore cloaks of grey or blue or crimson, though rain and sun had faded them so badly that it was hard to tell one colour from another. Others had badges sewn on their breasts. Brain spied axes, arrows, several salmon, a pine tree, an oak leaf, beetles, bantams, a boar's head, half a dozen tridents. Broken men, she realized, dregs from a dozen armies, the leavings of the lords. Some of the dead men had been bald and some bearded, some young and some old, some short, some tall, some fat, some thin. Swollen in death, with faces gnawed and rotten, they all looked the same. On the gallows tree, all men are brothers. Brain had read that in a book, though she could not recall which one. It was Heil Hunt who finally put words to what all of them had realized. These are the men who raided salt pans. May the father judge them harshly, said Meribald, who had been a friend to the town's aged septon. Who they were did not concern Brain half so much as who had hanged them. The noose was the preferred method of execution for Beric Dondarrion and his band of outlaws, it was said. If so, the so-called Lightning Lord might well be near. Dog barked, and Septon Meribald glanced about and frowned. Shall we keep a brisker pace? The sun will soon be setting, and corpses make poor company by night. These were dark and dangerous men alive. I doubt that death will have improved them. There we disagree, said Sir Heil. These are just the sort of fellows who are most improved by death. All the same, he put his heels into his horse, and they moved a little faster. Farther on, the trees began to thin, though not the corpses. The woods gave way to muddy fields, tree limbs to gibbets. Clouds of crows rose screeching from the bodies as the travellers came near, and settled again once they had passed. These were evil men, Brain reminded herself, yet the sight still made her sad. She forced herself to look at every man in turn, searching for familiar faces. A few she thought she recognized from Harrenhal, but their condition made it hard to be certain. None had a hound's head helm, but few had helms of any sort. Most had been stripped of arms, armor, and boots before they were strung up. When Podrick asked the name of the inn where they hoped to spend the night, Septon Meribald seized upon the question eagerly, perhaps to take their minds off the grisly sentinels along the roadside. The Old Inn, some call it. There has been an inn there for many hundreds of years, though this inn was only raised during the reign of the first Jehaerys, the king who built the King's Road. Jehaerys and his queen slept there during their journeys, it is said. For a time, the inn was known as the Two Crowns in their honour, until one innkeep built a bell tower and changed it to the Bellringer Inn. Later it passed to a crippled knight named Long John Heddle, who took up ironworking when he grew too old to fight. He forged a new sign for the yard, a three-headed dragon of black iron that he hung from a wooden post. The beast was so big it had to be made in a dozen pieces, joined with rope and wire. When the wind blew, it would clank and clatter, so the inn became known far and wide as the Clanking Dragon. "Is the dragon sign still there?" asked Podrick. "No," said Septon Meribald. "When the smith's son was an old man, a bastard son of the fourth Aegon rose up in rebellion against his true-born brother and took for his sigil a black dragon. These lands belonged to Lord Darry then, and his lordship was fiercely loyal to the king. The sight of the black iron dragon made him wroth. So he cut down the post, hacked the sign to pieces, and cast them into the river. One of the dragon's heads washed up on the Quiet Isle many years later, though by that time it was red with rust. The innkeep never hung another sign, so men forgot the dragon and took to calling the place the River Inn. In those days the trident flowed beneath its back door, and half its rooms were built out over the water. Guests could throw a line out their window and catch trout, it said. There was a ferry landing here as well, so travellers could cross to Lord Harroway's town and Whitewall's. We left the Trident south of here and have been riding north and west, not toward the river, but away from it. Aye, my lady, the Septon said. The river moved. 70 years ago it was. Or was it 80? It was when old Masha Heddle's grandfather kept the place. It was her who told me all this history. A kindly woman, Masha, fond of sour leaf and honey cakes. When she did not have a room for me, she would let me sleep beside the hearth, and she never sent me on my way without some bread and cheese and a few stale cakes. Is she the innkeep now? Asked Podrick. No, the lions hanged her. After they moved on, I heard that one of her nephews tried opening the inn again, but the wars had made the roads too dangerous for common folk to travel, so there was little custom. He brought in whores, but even that could not save him. Some lord killed him as well, I hear. Sir Hyle made a wry face. I never dreamed that keeping an inn could be so deadly dangerous. It is being common-born that is dangerous, when the great lords play their game of thrones, said Septon Meribald. Isn't that so, dog? Dog barked agreement. So, said Podrick, does the inn have a name now? The small folk call it the Crossroads Inn. Elder brother told me that two of Marsha Heddle's nieces have opened it to trade once again. He raised his staff. If the gods are good, that smoke rising beyond the hanged men will be from its chimneys. They could call the place the Gallows Inn, Sir Hyle said. By any name, the inn was large, rising 3 stories above the muddy roads. Its walls and turrets and chimneys made of fine white stone that glimmered pale and ghostly against the grey sky. Its south wing had been built upon heavy wooden pilings above a cracked and sunken expanse of weeds and dead brown grass. A thatch-roofed stable and a bell tower were attached to the north side. The whole sprawl was surrounded by a low wall of broken white stones overgrown by moss. At least no one has burned it down. At Saltpans they had found only death and desolation. By the time Brain and her companions were ferried over from the quiet isle, the survivors had fled, and the dead had been given to the ground. But the corpse of the town itself remained, ashen and unburied. The air still smelled of smoke, and the cries of the seagulls floating overhead sounded almost human, like the lamentations of lost children. Even the castle had seemed forlorn and abandoned. Grey as the ashes of the town around it, the castle consisted of a square keep, girded by a curtain wall, built so as to overlook the harbour. It was closed tight as Brian and the others led their horses off the ferry, nothing moving on its battlements but banners. It took a quarter hour of dogs barking and Septon Meribald's knocking on the front gate with his quarterstaff before a woman appeared above them to demand their business. By that time the ferry had departed, and it had begun to rain. "I am a holy Septon, good lady," Meribald had shouted up, "and these are honest travellers. We seek shelter from the rain, and a place by your fire for the night." The woman had been unmoved by his appeals. "The closest inn is at the crossroads to the west," she replied. "We want no strangers here. Begone." Once she vanished, neither Meribald's prayers, dog's barks, nor Sir Hyle's curses could bring her back. In the end they had spent the night in the woods beneath a shelter made of woven branches. There was life at the Crossroads Inn, though. Even before they reached the gate, Brain heard the sound. A hammering, faint but steady. It had a steely ring. "A forge," Sir Hyle said. "Either they have themselves a smith, or the old innkeep's ghost is making another iron dragon." He put his heels into his horse. "I hope they have a ghostly cook as well. A crisp roast chicken would set the world aright." The inn's yard was a sea of brown mud that sucked at the hooves of the horses. The clang of steel was louder here, and Brain saw the red glow of the forge down past the far end of the stables, behind an ox cart with a broken wheel. She could see horses in the stables too, and a small boy was swinging from the rusted chains of the weathered gibbet that loomed above the yard. 4 girls stood on the inn's porch, watching him. The youngest was no more than 2, and naked. The oldest, 9 or 10, stood with her arms protectively about the little one. "Girls," Sir Hyle called to them, "run fetch your mother." The boy dropped from the chain and dashed off toward the stables. The 4 girls stood fidgeting. After a moment, one said, "We have no mothers." And another added, "I had one, but they killed her." The oldest of the four stepped forward, pushing the little one behind her skirts. "Who are you?" she demanded. "Honest travellers seeking shelter. My name is Brian, and this is Septon Meribald, who is well known through the Riverlands. The boy is my squire, Podrick Payne. The knight, Sir Hyle Hunt." The hammering stopped suddenly. The girl on the porch looked them over, wary as only a 10-year-old can be. "I'm Willow. Will you be wanting beds?" "Beds and ale and hot food to fill our bellies," said Sir Hyle Hunt as he dismounted. "Are you the innkeep?" She shook her head. "That's my sister Jane. She's not here. All we have to eat is horse meat. If you come for whores, there are none. My sister run them off. We have beds, though. Some feather beds, but more a straw." "And all have fleas, I don't doubt," said Sir Hyle. "Do you have coin to pay? Silver?" Sir Hyle laughed. "Silver? For a knight's bed and a haunch of horse? Do you mean to rob us, child?" "We'll have silver, else you can sleep in the woods with the dead men." Willow glanced toward the donkey and the casks and bundles on his back. "Is that food? Where did you get it?"
"Maidenpool," said Meribald. Dog barked. "Do you question all your guests this way?" asked Sir Hyle.
"We don't have so many guests, not like before the war. It's mostly sparrows on the roads these days, or worse."
"Worse?" Brian asked. "Thieves," said a boy's voice from the stables.
"Robbers."
Brian turned and saw a ghost.
Renly.
No hammer blow to the heart could have felled her half so hard.
"My lord," she gasped.
"Lord?" The boy pushed back a lock of black hair that had fallen across his eyes.
"I'm just a smith."
"He is not Renly," Brian realized. "Renly is dead. Renly died in my arms, a man of 21. This is only a boy." A boy who looked, as Renly had, the first time he came to Tarth. "No, younger. His jaw is squarer, his brows bushier." Renly had been lean and lithe, whereas this boy had the heavy shoulders and muscular right arm so often seen on smiths. He wore a long leather apron, but under it his chest was bare. A dark stubble covered his cheeks and chin, and his hair was a thick black mop that grew down past his ears. King Renly's hair had been that same coal black, but his had always been washed and brushed and combed. Sometimes he cut it short, and sometimes he let it fall loose to his shoulders, or tied it back behind his head with a golden ribbon, but it was never tangled or matted with sweat. And though his eyes had been that same deep blue, Lord Renly's eyes had always been warm and welcoming, full of laughter, whereas this boy's eyes brimmed with anger and suspicion. Septon Meribald saw it too. "We mean no harm, lad. When Marcia Heddle owned this inn, she always had a honey cake for me. Sometimes she even let me have a bed if the inn was not full."
"She's dead," the boy said. "The lions hanged her."
"Hanging seems your favourite sport in these parts," said Sir Hyle Hunt. "Would that I had some land hereabouts. I'd plant hemp, sell rope, and make my fortune."
"Or these children,"
Brian said to the girl, Willow. "Are they your sisters, brothers, kin, and cousins?"
"No," Willow was staring at her in a way that she knew well. "They're just, I don't know. The sparrows bring them here sometimes. Others find their own way."
"If you're a woman, why are you dressed up like a man?" Septon Meribald answered. "Lady Brian is a warrior maid upon a quest. Just now, though, she is in need of a dry bed and a warm fire, as are we all. My old bones say it's going to rain again, and soon. Do you have rooms for us?"
"No," said the boysmith.
"Yes," said the girl Willow. They glared at one another. Then Willow stomped her foot.
"They have food, gentry. The little ones are hungry."
She whistled, and more children appeared as if by magic. Ragged boys with unshorn locks crept from under the porch, and furtive girls appeared in the windows overlooking the yard. Some clutched crossbows, wound and loaded.
"They could call it Crossbow Inn," Sir Hyle suggested.
"Orphan Inn would be more apt," thought Brain.
"What? You help them with those horses," said Willow. "Will, put down that rock. They've not come to hurt us. Tansy, Pate,
Run get some wood to feed the fire. John Penny, you help the Septon with those bundles. I'll show them to some rooms. In the end, they took three rooms adjoining one another, each boasting a feather bed, a chamber pot, and a